Hello, and welcome to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the News Extra edition for the week ending Saturday the 23rd of December 2017, and I'm its editor, Steve. In this programme we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser, followed by our selection of some interesting BBC radio programmes coming up in the next few days. We also have the second in our series of Community Matters interviews with local charities and volunteer groups. Today's music is by Goffby and is called Hello Dawn. And as you might expect in this run-up to Christmas, a lot of the news stories today certainly reflect the time of year, and they are read by Gabby, Fiona, Jilly and Elaine.
My name is Gabby, and my first article is about hotel and restaurants plan for former BHS site. The long-empty BHS building in the heart of St Albans city centre is finally set for redevelopment. The St Peter Street store closed in August 2016, following the liquidation of British Home Stores. A subsequent Facebook petition called for it to be taken over by the John Lewis Partnership, but other suggested tenants included a Primark or Debenhams. However, a property and investment company is now consulting on plans to replace it with a 131-bed hotel plus two restaurants on the ground floor. Development director at Reef Group, Will Roholder, said, "The proposed new hotel and restaurants will be an exciting addition to St Albans city centre, and will provide an enhanced presence to St Peter Street and activity to Drover's Way by replacing the existing tired facades with high-quality elevations. In addition, it will assist in facilitating future tourism as well as providing employment opportunities. I look forward to receiving the public's views on our proposals." The development includes significant improvements to the thoroughfare linking St Peter Street and Drover's Way, and would create 50 new jobs on opening. Reef Group has completed, or is in the process of developing, other sites across the UK in Oxford City Centre, Horsham Town Centre, Winchester, Camden, Acton and Aldgate. St Albans Civic Society's Eric Roberts, who gave pre-consultation input, said, "We have given it the thumbs up on the understanding the option is kept open to have the ground floor not just retained, but used for retail to keep the commercial frontage. It has been standing empty for nearly 2 years, and with the opening of the museum and gallery, and the city seeming to want to make more of a go at being a tourist destination, it would be good to get people to stay out more. We cannot see who is going to move in there, and it's a bit like a gap in your front teeth. But we did say we would prefer to see the ground floor stay as retail and not just used for eating and drinking, if that were possible. However, on principle, we agreed with it. It's about the confidence in St Albans' future, and this could stimulate trade. The proof of the pudding will be in the detail. St Albans Business Improvement District, BID, manager Helen Burridge added, "The BID looks forward to seeing the plans and talking to its members to hear their thoughts." The public consultation will be held on Thursday, January the 4th, between 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. at Lower Hall, Trinity United Reformed Church, 1 Beaconsfield Road, St Albans, AL1 3RD. And there's a picture of the old BHS store with the sale sign still up in the window, but it does look rather tired and sad.
Hello, my name's Fiona. My first news headline says, "County backlash against airport expansion bid." Plans to expand Luton Airport to accommodate 36 to 38 million passengers have met with concern from Hertfordshire County Council. The owners of the airport, Luton Borough Council, have defended their plans for the growth, arguing that the 20-year Luton investment framework will create 18,500 jobs and benefit the regional economy. Councillor Andy Malcolm, Chair of the London Luton Airport Limited and Luton Council's portfolio holder for finance, said, "London Luton Airport is a huge success story. On the back of 44 consecutive months of passenger growth, it is the fifth largest and fastest growing major airport in the UK, sustaining an estimated 33,000 jobs across the region and contributing more than £1.5 billion per year into the UK economy. The airport's growth has been so fast, in fact, that at its current rate, it is due to reach the current permitted capacity of 18 million passengers per annum in 2021. For every million passengers travelling through the airport, there is an estimated increase of up to 800 new jobs and £76 million uplift for the regional economy." Councillor Malcolm added, "We are acutely aware of the consequences of having an international airport on the doorstep. Our commitment is to bring forward not only a more modern and efficient, but also an environmentally and socially responsible London Luton Airport." The County Council, while recognising the potential economic benefits of the expansion, shares the concerns of noise campaign groups who are worried about the impact increased air travel will have on the community. County Council leader David Williams said, "I can imagine how news of this proposal will be received in the communities in Hertfordshire whose lives are already blighted by aircraft noise created by the airport, even with the current passenger numbers. My main concern at this stage, therefore, is the impact this news will have on these communities. My other immediate concern is the transport implications. How can that level of growth possibly be achieved without compromising the capacity of our road and rail systems? And how can it be done in a way which shifts journeys to the airport away from the car and towards public transport?"
Hello, my name is Gilly, and my first story is about the council who have been spared watchdogs' wrath after 11 taxpayers were caught up in a data breach. The Information Commissioner has decided not to punish St Albans District Council after it sent taxpayers' bank details to the wrong people. On Thursday, October the 5th, St Albans District Council sent out several council tax demands, liability order notifications and direct debit confirmation letters. Some of the letters were enveloped incorrectly, meaning residents received both their own letter and another person's. The council's deputy chief executive, Colm O'Callaghan, said, "We have apologised to the individuals concerned for this regrettable data breach. We notified the Information Commissioner's office, which carried out an investigation and decided no action needed to be taken against us." The Commissioner made three recommendations about future working practices, and we have already implemented two of those. We will soon take on board the third. The Council holds a considerable amount of personal data, and the security of that data is a major priority. Fortunately, this breach is an isolated incident, and no harm appears to have resulted from it. The council knows of 11 people who were affected by this breach, and four of the letters included bank details. Everyone who could have been affected has been written to, and it is not known if anyone has become a victim of fraud because of the error. The council says a failure to follow procedure and a machine fault were behind the breach. They became aware of the breach on Friday, October the 6th, and discovered the number of people who had been affected on Tuesday, October the 10th. The breach was reported to the Information Commissioner's office on Thursday, October the 12th. The Commissioner previously found St Albans Council had breached the Data Protection Act in 2010 after a laptop containing the postal vote records of 14,500 people was stolen. Although the data was password protected, it was not encrypted. Where data is converted from a readable format to a version that can only be opened with the decryption key. Instant messaging apps such as WhatsApp use encryption to ensure messages can only be seen by the author and the intended recipient.
Hello, my name is Elaine, and my first article is Campaign Aims to Tackle Isolation Over Festive Period. A Harpenden volunteer is urging residents to help prevent older people from feeling lonely over Christmas. Harts County Council is taking part in the End Loneliness campaign in response to studies showing that older people who are isolated are at a greater risk of ill health. The research suggests loneliness can be as bad for your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day, and can be worse for you than obesity and physical inactivity. Louisa, an Age UK volunteer from Harpenden, said, "My mother-in-law came to live with us for the last 4 years of her life when she became very dependent. It made me realise how lonely older people can feel, and this inspired me to volunteer to spend some time with the elderly. It also opened our family's eyes to the challenges of getting older. Age UK introduced me to Margaret in January 2017. I visit her once a week and spend about an hour with her. We chat over tea and sometimes go into town to get a coffee. Margaret is a lovely lady and very independent. She is passionate about jigsaws, and I look forward to seeing which one she has completed each week. She also loves reading, colouring, Sudoku, and finding amusing news in the papers. We enjoy each other's company, chatting about the latest news, our lives and experiences. Margaret never tires of hearing about my family life and will always offer a helpful suggestion or two when I share something with her. It's great to feel that I'm giving something back while also having an enriched life. We all need to look out for the elderly in our community. One day we may be in their situation." The County Council is offering tips to help elderly people over Christmas, including helping them with Christmas cards, decorations, or buying and wrapping presents, inviting an older person over for a chat and helping them join a social club, as well as smaller gestures like taking their bins out for them. Colette Wyatt-Lowe, Cabinet Member for Adult Care and Health, said, "No one should be alone at Christmas, or indeed any other time of year. We are calling on people to take time over the festive period and beyond to check in on older and vulnerable neighbours, friends and relatives to make sure they are warm and well." And there's a lovely picture with this article of Louisa and Margaret laughing over one of the jigsaw puzzles.
Have lessons been learned in the wake of district's rejected local plan? A frustrated Green Belt defender is concerned St Albans District Council, SADC, has not learnt any lessons from the mistakes of the debunked local plan. SADC has responded to the local plan, LP, consultations by neighbouring councils Decorum and Hartsmere. One of the suggested sites in Decorum's plan crosses the SADC boundary into Greenbelt land near Redbourne, which is owned by the Crown Estate. Decorum is considering 4,500 homes for the site. The site was also earmarked by SADC for a major development as part of its own failed LP. Hartsmere's includes developments northeast of Radlett and bordering London Colney by the M25. Redbourne Parish Council Chairman David Mitchell is asking why the North Hemel Hempstead site is not explicitly mentioned in SADC's response to Decorum, but the Radlett and London Colney site are specifically addressed in the Hartsmere reply. He said, "It makes you wonder if there's a deal being done behind closed doors. I was very surprised that they haven't addressed it at all." Which, given that the St Albans themselves were proposing to build to the east of Hemel Hempstead in the now debunked SLP, means we would be looking at, in total, something like 7,000 houses in the area. David said the points made about transport links and infrastructure issues raised to Hartsmere would also be valid for Decorum, but are not argued. He added, "It makes you wonder whether the planning system at St Albans is fit for purpose. All the evidence points to the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. After the debacle of the last LP, you would have thought we would have been more honest and transparent. Responding to Hartsmere, SADC said the justification for the potential creation of a new settlement at the boundary with SADC is unclear. Normally, a fundamental part of considering a potential new freestanding settlement would be its location with regard to the strategic road and rail network and opportunities to enhance these connections, access to and provision of jobs, etc. This location would appear to depend entirely on road access. Further, that road access appears to depend heavily on direct access to the M25 motorway, which is designed to facilitate long-distance movement, not local access. Dacorum's cross-boundary development is mentioned, just not explicitly. Cross-boundary development in SADC's area appears to still be being considered by DBC as an option for accommodation of DBC-generated need. SADC's last LP was rejected in High Court for not cooperating fully with neighbouring councils, in particular with regard to proposed settlements close to their borders, like East Hemel Hempstead. Both Dacorum and Hartsmere were part of the South West Harts group that challenged SADC on this point. Portfolio holder for planning at SADC, Councillor Mary Maynard, said, "There is nothing unusual about our LP talks with neighbouring local authorities. Indeed, we have a legal duty to cooperate with them during the plan-making process, which means talking with them about possible plans. Our talks include potential strategic cross-boundary issues, such as the possible housing options east and north of Hemel Hempstead and near London Colney, and the need for more infrastructure as we grow. Councils are all putting forward options for consideration at this stage, and are holding these discussions in order to produce effective and deliverable policies." She stressed SADC's new LP consultation will start next month, and all views have been taken on board before the document is put before a meeting of the full council.
Police waste £12,500 on private eye court case. And my next story is accompanied by a photo of the quite famous private eye editor Ian Hislop at home in his private eye office. Harts Police wasted £12,500 of taxpayers' money on a court case against Private Eye, it has been revealed. The force, whose commissioner wants more money from council tax next year, wanted the satirical magazine to hand over a list of subscribers in the county. When Private Eye refused, the police sought a production order under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1985. This was rejected by a Crown Court judge, but not before £12,500 had been spent by the cops, according to the Times. The application was made after a Muslim woman who worked at Hatfield Police Station was sent a joke about the Manchester terrorist attacks. The joke had been cut from a June copy of The Private Eye and sent through the force's internal mail, meaning it must have been sent by a police officer or a member of staff. A police spokesperson said, "Hertfordshire Constabulary treat all allegations of hate crime seriously and will actively pursue inquiries that may help to identify those who commit these crimes." On this occasion, Private Eye has decided not to assist the police investigation, and that's a matter for them. "We will continue to investigate allegations of hate crime using all our available resources." Private Eye's editor Ian Hislop said on the magazine's podcast, "It's a pretty flabbergasting. The strangeness of the case was absolutely bizarre. We did try and cooperate and explain perhaps this was not a subscriber, perhaps they had bought it in a shop, or perhaps they had been given it by a friend, or even photocopied a cartoon from someone who'd sent it over the internet. It did strike me the essential detective work didn't seem to have been done, and we did try to explain that. But then they took us to court anyway, and we didn't have any choice. We had to get in a barrister and defend ourselves." Happily, the judge threw the case out. Judge David Farrell QC also told Hearts Police to pay the costs for both sides.
This is about a dad and daughter duo who reached the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro even after an injury threatened to scupper their plans. Annabelle Richardson, 16, and her dad Paul from Harpenden planned to tackle the Tanzanian mountain until Paul broke his collarbone in a cycle ride with the Harpenden Raiders Cycling Club. Paul, 57, said, "We had booked a family holiday to Mexico, flying out 5 days after the accident, and I didn't want to let Annabelle or my wife Nadini down. So I put off any treatment and went on the holiday, hoping the bones might knit together naturally. They didn't." Needing surgery, Paul, who works as a trustee director for Independent Age, went for an MRI scan at Spire Harpenden Hospital, meeting with consultant orthopaedic surgeon Tony Corner. He explained that Paul's collarbone was broken in three places, with two of the fractures near the shoulder joint, and that he would need a collarbone reconstruction to get fit in time for the climb. Annabelle, a pupil at Queenswood School in Hatfield, said, "I have to admit I was a bit cross with my dad when I first heard about the injury, but I was determined to help him get through it all, so I was right behind him as he worked hard to get back to fitness." He only had 10 weeks from leaving hospital until we started the climb, so I was really proud of him when the doctor gave him the okay to climb just a week before we were due to set off. To reach the summit, Paul and Annabelle had to climb for up to 14 hours a day in the freezing cold. In doing so, they raised £1,400 for the charity War Child. Annabelle said, "Sometimes we actually had to start climbing at midnight in the pitch dark, and I did suffer a bit from being at high altitude, but it was a case of slowly does it, and eventually we reached the top. It was a fantastic feeling, especially as we'd built up such a great friendship with our fellow climbers. Everyone was smiling and hugging each other, and although we were all exhausted, we were all very happy." Paul praised his surgeon and the physio team at Spire Harpenden for helping him get better in time for the expedition. He said, "In the end, I'm so pleased we did the climb. It really was an unforgettable experience, and I'm so proud of the way Annabelle handled it." And there's a lovely picture of Annabelle and Paul at the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, smiling broadly.
Sailor Shona races across Southern Ocean for charity. It's neck and neck for a St Albans sailor racing across the Southern Ocean for charity. London Colney's Shona Davis is raising money for Mind in Mid-Hearts by helping to crew a 70-foot yacht on two legs of a 40,000 nautical mile dash across the Southern Hemisphere. It is part of the six-month Clipper Round the World Yacht Race. Her boat is called Dare to Lead and is currently in fifth place. She hopes to collect £20,000 by sailing 5,000 miles from Western to Eastern Australia and 7,000 miles from Australia to Northern China via Vietnam. The cause is close to Shona's heart because she was helped by the charity during a mental breakdown in 2015. Shona has had to deal with standing at a constant 45-degree angle, 75-knot winds, and only 2 hours after she set off in mid-October, she collided face-first with a Hank travelling at 15 miles per hour and smashed her knee on a rivet. She said, "Living at 45 degrees is tough. Despite reading all the blogs and having been through clipper training, I was not prepared for the effect of prolonged time living at this angle. Being jolted out of sleep every time the boat goes airborne and slams back into the water. Cooking, walking, ablutions. Who knew brushing your teeth would require every muscle in your body?" She added, "I've run the full gamut of emotions, from fear to frustration, joy to pain, tears to smiles, and then anger." She entered the race partly to better her mental health. But when I was in the depths of my depression, I had to summon every ounce of energy. I had just to get out of bed and have a shower. It took a whole day to steel myself for a conversation with someone. That's how I felt 2 days ago, that facing another day was going to be torture and would require every bit of strength I have. Then she remembered all the kindness around her. Lou helped to get her jacket off and tried to make her laugh. Paddy fetched water. Malcolm found ibuprofen. And Sam offered spare fleeces, and Aunt loaned the inner lining of his sleeping bag so she could keep her sleeping bag dry. I showed that I was in a weak spot, and the help and love flowed in.
This article is about the Talking Newspaper. Staff and customers at a St Albans co-op have raised nearly £2,000 for the city's Talking Newspaper. Customers at the shop in Selbarnes Lane raised £1,790.07 for the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, SADTN, through the Co-op Local Community Fund. Leonie, wife of store manager Tom Digby, raised a further £79 by holding a cake bake, helped by her son Teddy and staff member Joseph. SADTN volunteers Jenny Sean and Robin Christofferu received donations and showed customers how the Talking Newspaper provides visually impaired residents with a weekly audio programme of local news, including stories from the Hearts Advertiser. Robin said, "These funds will help us to add to our recording studio facilities and also enable us to reach out to those who, for whatever reason, are unable to pick up and read newspapers and magazines, whether they're living at home or in residential care." And there's a nice picture of Teddy, Joseph and Tom handing the cheque over to Robin and Jenny in the co-op store.
Better or worse? Punters give their verdicts on City's Christmas market. Punters at St Albans Christmas Market have given their verdict on this year's festive event. Since opening up, the Yuletide Market has lost £230,000 and never made a profit. But last year's £53,000 bill was an improvement on the loss of £57,449 in 2014 and £79,455 in 2013. In previous years, it was criticised for inconvenient opening hours, expensive chalet renting, a lack of atmosphere, and a slightly out-of-centre location. This year, the market is open closer to Christmas. It's all enclosed in the Vintry Gardens, and it features entertainment from local performers and groups. A charity card stall holder, Claire Reynolds, said, "It seems to be quite quiet today, and I don't know whether that's because it's a Tuesday. People seem to be walking through as they pass through the city rather than out with a view to buy gifts. So we've already slashed our prices today because we want to sell as much as possible." Customers Jackie and Nancy Taslak visit the market every year. Jackie said, "We've just arrived, but it's okay. We've just made our first purchase. We've bought 2 Christmas tree decorations and we're quite excited." Nancy liked the setup. "I think they organised the food section much better this time, having it all together rather than chaotically like last time." Keith Rofe came on a coach day trip from Buckinghamshire to St Albans. "This is a bit small, really. Is this it? It seems quite small. I expected there to be a lot more stalls. We saw there's a normal market here, I assume on a Wednesday, but it's a start and we'll certainly be coming back. There's more food and drink than anything else, really. We expected to see more Christmassy-type decorations, cards, stuff like that." A bespoke woodturner, Richard Hatton, was selling his wares. "It's slightly smaller this year, but I think it's better quality, better atmosphere." He said the layout created a good meeting place ambience. Angela Mitten was perusing the stalls at a time without scheduled entertainment. "I think what is missing is music, because I've just come back from the German Christmas markets, and always if you have music, it just adds to the festivities. This feels a little flat." She said although St Albans District Council are doing their best, it has a long way to go before it gets anything like some of the other cathedral city markets. The head of the Community Services for St Albans District Council, Debbie White, said, "The Christmas market is now in its fifth year and it has become an established part of the festive season in St Albans. We've lost 2 days because of snow and suffered one particularly rainy weekend, so the total number of visitors might be slightly down on last year's record of 118,000. However, we have had a lot of very positive feedback. The snow globe, where families can have a memorable photograph taken, has been especially popular, as has been the Tinseltown TP, which has been showcasing local musicians and other talented entertainers." She said that after listening to all the feedback we received about last year's event, they've made a number of changes this year, including extending the event by 4 days so it was as close to Christmas as possible. She added that the council will continue to listen to suggestions from traders, shoppers and residents when improving next year's event. "To help us do so, we're seeking people willing to take part in workshops early next year to help shape the future direction of this event."
A crowd gathered in front of St Albans Clock Tower to light a 6-foot menorah for the Jewish festival of Hanukkah. The city's third annual menorah lighting was organised by St Albans Synagogue to celebrate what is known as the Festival of Lights. 9 candles were lit on the menorah, a candelabrum called a Hanukkiah, for the final day of the 8-day festival. St Albans United Synagogue Minister Rabbi Daniel Sturgis said, "One of the central themes of Hanukkah is bringing light into the world. So as we light the Hanukkiah, we think of and pray for those who are struggling, suffering in life. We pray for them and we think how we in our own lives can bring more light into the world. Religious freedom is something we can easily take for granted in the UK in 2017, but we mustn't take it for granted." And there's a picture of the St Albans United Synagogue member Steve Waxman with the lit Hanukkiah.
Local communities are lighting up windows all over the city to raise money for charities this Christmas. Another living Advent calendar has popped up on Prospect Road. Each day of December, a window display is revealed in aid of a drop-in centre for homeless people, Centre 33. The neighbours have already smashed their £125 target and collected £160. Organiser Kate Maguire, 36, has lived on the street for 5 years. "People have really enjoyed the community spirit, and it's nice for people walking down the street to see them go up. It's got a festive Christmas feeling and I'm glad we can get everyone together." She said she was amazed at the range of creative displays residents have made, adding, "It's a local charity and it's something people feel quite strongly about because people are much more aware of the needs of homeless people at Christmas. Of course it's relevant all year around, but this is a time in winter that people need more help and support. People have been generous and I have been really pleased." Kate revealed her Christmas tree themed window on December the 2nd. The trend is gaining momentum around St Albans. A similar living Advent calendar on Ladysmith Road, Kimberley Road, Folly Avenue and Cannon Street is raising money for Great Ormond Street Hospital and Keach Hospice. They have raised more than £3,000 since 2015. A Kimberley Road resident who has seen window displays all around the city, Amy Edlin, 24, said it's so lovely seeing the windows spring up around this time of year. "It's so nice to see the efforts people go to and it brings a real sense of community. They are for such wonderful causes and not only does it raise money, but it also raises awareness." She said seeing them has really put her in the festive spirit.
Christmas Lights Cash helps disabled children. A St Albans home has lit up for Christmas to help raise money for a children's charity. Frank Clark, 78, of Vicarage Close, has erected a gazebo filled with decorations for Dream Flight for the past few years. Mr Clark said, the children have not got long. Last year, three children came to the door and said they had seen it and went to get money. It has me in tears. Mr. Clark paid for all the lights and a snow machine himself, and admirers leave donations in a bucket next to the tent. He raised £150 from the lights last Christmas, but is hoping to hit a target of £2,000 this time. A Dreamflight spokesperson said, "Each October, Dreamflight takes a plane full of amazing children for a holiday of a lifetime. The charity hires a 747 aircraft and takes 192 children from across the UK with a serious illness or disability to Florida. Parents are not allowed, but instead a huge volunteer team of doctors, nurses, physiotherapists and other helpers look after the children for 10 days. Dreamflight is not just a holiday. It does something that medicine can't. The children get the opportunity to discover independence, confidence and a whole new outlook on life. Often, for the first time, they realise that they are not the odd one out. They see children around them who have also suffered. They gain perspective and experience things that they never thought possible. Each child's place costs the charity approximately £3,500. Without the help of fundraisers and supporters, the trip could not go ahead, as Dreamflight gets no government funding. Dreamflight take children aged between 8 and 14, and previous children have gone on to be Paralympic champions. The charity require around £750,000 every year to keep running the flights, and each trip takes around 300 volunteers. Hitchin-born golfer Ian Poulter is one of the patrons of the charity, and he has previously organised golf days for Dreamflight, raising £22,000. And there's a nice photograph of Mr. Clark's decorations. There's a snowman with a large red hat on his head, and behind him are two reindeers all lit up with fairy lights, which is rather nice.
Following that last story about Christmas lights, here's another one. City centre families hoping to shine above the rest in Christmas lights competition. St Albans homes have been laden with LEDs to be in with a chance of winning the Roads in Bloom Christmas lights competition. 130 families from Alma, Bedford, Alexandra and Inkerman Roads are hoping to celebrate Christmas with a first place prize of 2 bottles of champagne. Judging their efforts will be representatives from Aylett's Nurseries, Rennie Grove and County Councillor Chris White. Councillor White said, "It's an astonishingly fabulous thing to do. There are many chores in being a councillor, but this is not one of them. The imagination of the residents and work that David Glanville puts in is gratifying because it's all for charity. It also cheers up an area that a few years ago was down in the dumps because of major drainage works." But David said, "No, we're going to hold it this summer. Roads in Bloom has been running since 2013 with summer flower and Christmas lights competitions. Since then, organisers like David Glanville have raised £11,000 for charity." David said, "We had upgraded sewage work in Bedford and Inkerman Roads, and it left the roads dull and dreary. So I started a Roads in Bloom competition with 35 households, and it's just escalated from there. We're helping the community, and we're giving back to St Albans by helping local charities." Councillor White said he will be looking for originality, for it to be made by the competitors themselves and to have a bit of a sense of humour. One year, a family painted the three bollards next to their house into three wise men. Aside from Aylett Nurseries, other sponsors include The Pudding Stop, Aubrey & Finn, F&S Barbers, Loft and Rayner Essex. They and several others have all sponsored raffle prizes with a bottle of champagne for second. Third place will win 2 bottles of wine and fourth will win a box of chocolates. Rennie Grove Hospice, Centre 33 and Open Door will each receive a third of the money raised. The competition finished yesterday and judging takes place today, Thursday. Winners will be announced on Radio Verulam on Friday.
Well, the Boxing Day Mummers are back. The Mummers will again entertain audiences in St Albans with performances of St George and the Dragon on Boxing Day. For the 51st year running and at five locations around the city, actors will reenact the time-honoured mystery play and are inviting everybody to join in the festivities. It will include fierce battles, dubious cures unknown to science, excruciating poetry, awful jokes, and a less than serious look at life, death, and resurrection. There will be audience participation and topical references, ensuring that every performance is slightly different and unique. The first time St Albans Mummers performed this play was in 1967, and the story remains largely the same in 2017. It will take place at 11:30 a.m. by the Town Hall, 12:15 p.m. by the White Hart Hotel, 1 p.m. at the west end of St Albans Abbey, 1:45 p.m. by Ye Olde Fighting Cocks, and 2:30 p.m. by St Albans Clock Tower. And there's a picture of all of them in their outfits, their dress, and they're all giggling like mad and having a wonderful time.
Snow proves no obstacle to Cubs Christmas deliveries. Harpenden Cub Scouts brave the snow to deliver Christmas cards on behalf of elderly residents. The Cubs set out for the 34th year in a row to deliver cards collected from different post boxes around the town. Around 3,500 cards were sorted by 85 Cubs at the Crabtree Fields Scout headquarters on Saturday, December the 9th. They set out to deliver the cards around the town the following day, despite the heavy rainfall. Ricky Harrington, who originated the scheme and organises every year, said, "This is the first year ever we have managed to get them all delivered on that Sunday because of the snow. This is the 34th year we have been doing it." The Cubs visited some elderly people that they know personally, and then we have 11 post boxes at various points around Harpenden, in churches, in charity shops, and in various old people's homes. They go round with a parent, and depending on whether the cards are in their immediate neighbourhood, they walk, sledge, or go by car. The event was attended by Harpenden Mayor, Councillor Rosemary Farmer. Ricky estimates that the scheme has saved users around £60,000 in postage over its years of operation. He said it's great fun. The snow added a new dimension to it. We always stick to our Be Prepared motto, so we always leave at least 1 week between delivery and Christmas itself, with at least one full weekend. This year, we left two full weekends. The extra time allows the Cubs to solve the mystery of cards with vague addresses and deliver them to the right places. Ricky said they had a fantastic day. "I think we were all very worried when we saw the forecast developing, but there were smiling faces and they got to build snowmen and then go off to deliver the cards. We had great feedback from the Cubs and their parents, as well as the people we deliver the cards from. And there's four lovely pictures here. There's one of the mayor with three of the children, Daniel, Rosie and Lauren. And then there are three separate pictures, each with the children posting into different boxes. One is Edward, one's Nina and one is George."
And that's the end of the news. And now the list of people whose deaths were announced this week. James William Crotty, aged 93 years. Leonard Evans, aged 90. Roy Lofthouse, also aged 90. Barry Payne, aged 78. And Sheila Margaret Satchel, aged 82 years. And now, a little more music. Then we'll have our selection of some good bits of BBC Radio. Because there is no programme next week, our selections will cover the period into the new year. Thank you.
now for a look at some of the radio highlights in this coming Christmas week. We start with Saturday the 23rd of December, and at 2:30 p.m. on Radio 4 is Turgenev's First Love. Ivan Turgenev's autobiographical novella, published in 1860, which tells the story of Vladimir Petrovich, a young man finding himself entangled in illicit passion and betrayal. This is followed at 3:45 p.m. by Survivors. Tamsin Gregg reads a specially commissioned short Christmas story by Laura Barnett. Over to Radio 3 at 6:30 p.m. and in Opera on 3 from the Met, a chance to hear Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. Continuing with Saturday the 23rd of December, on Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m. is Choice, Michael Palin's Radio Adventures. John McCarthy in a long conversation with Michael Palin as he reveals his love for radio and the many contributions he has made to it over the years, with guest appearances from Barry Cryer and John Finnemore. On Radio 4 at 9 p.m, a chance to hear again the second and final part of The Scarlet Pimpernel. Then back to Radio 3 at 12 midnight for Geoffrey Smith's Jazz, in which he celebrates the centenary of Ella Fitzgerald's birth, with highlights from her songbook series, including classic tunes by Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hart, and Duke Ellington. Worth staying awake for.
Moving on to Christmas Eve, and Radio 3 devotes a whole day to Bach as the week-long Spirit of Bach celebration draws to a close. Starting at 7 a.m. with the last prelude and fuge of the composer's well-tempered clavier, then at 9 a.m. a selection of organ works from his Christmas oratorio. Continuing right throughout the day with a varied programme as enthusiasts and singers alike discuss their memories of listening and playing. More of Bach's music, of course, with at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3, In Concert, his Mass in B minor. We turn now to Radio 4, and at 11:15 a.m, Kirsty Young's Castaway on Desert Island Discs is Strictly Come Dancing judge Bruno Tognoli, followed by at 12 noon the last in the current series of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. Then, still Christmas Eve, 3 p.m. on Radio 4, comes a festival of nine lessons and carols, the annual service broadcast live from King's College Chapel, Cambridge. This will be repeated on Christmas Day at 2 p.m. Staying with a Christmas theme, over on Classic FM at 6 p.m. is the annual Children and the Arts Christmas Carol Concert, an uplifting mix of classical music and carol singing, with readings from Brian Blessed, Adrian Lester, Ben Miller and Felicity Jones. At 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4 is Just William and the first part of the Christmas Truce, performed by Martin Jarvis. The concluding part is on New Year's Eve at 7:15 p.m. Then on Radio 4 at 10:15 p.m. you can hear Pick of the Year, a look back at the year's radio highlights. Finally, at 11:30 p.m. is Midnight Mass from the Metropolitan Cathedral of Christ the King in Liverpool.
And so to Christmas Day. Classic FM starts the day at 6 a.m. with 4 hours of festive music and reports from listeners on how they are spending their Christmas morning. On Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. comes Drama, Mr. Betjeman's Class, the first of two plays celebrating the life of John Betjeman. The first opens in 1928 with the poet, aged 23, leaving Magdalen College without a degree. Followed at 3 p.m. of course by Her Majesty the Queen's annual Christmas message. And if you haven't yet had your fill of Christmas carols, on Classic FM at 3:05 p.m. is the Buckingham Palace Carol Concert for the Royal Household. On Radio 3 at 5 p.m. is Simon Callow's Dickensian Christmas. Callow, who has both played Dickens and written about him, celebrates the author, interspersed with carols of the era sung by the BBC singers. Back with Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. and lovers of Just a Minute will enjoy hearing Nicholas Parsons and guests celebrate the show's 50th anniversary. Finally, for Christmas Day, on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m, from this year's BBC Proms Festival, a chance to hear Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma.
And now a look at those programmes that are broadcast each day at the same time. Book of the Week at 9:45 a.m. each morning on Radio 4 is Adventures of a Young Naturalist. David Attenborough reads from his memoirs in the 1950s to find animals for London Zoo. Repeated at 12:30 a.m. On Radio 3 at 12 noon each day, Composer of the Week is Cole Porter. Includes recordings by Judy Garland, Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby. Still with Radio 3, the lunchtime concert at 1 p.m. presents performances from the 2017 Schubertiad in Schwarzenberg, Austria. At 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4 is Pen Pals, a celebration of letter writing in which a different celebrity each day discusses their pen pal. Still with Radio 4 at 7:45 p.m. is Incredible Women, a spoof documentary in which Rebecca Front explores the lives of fictional women. Finally, Book at Bedtime at 10:45 p.m, also on Radio 4, is How to Stop Time by Matt Haig. Tom Hazard has a condition which slows the ageing process.
We move on now to Boxing Day, 26th of December. At 9 a.m. on Radio 4 is Black Music in Europe, A Hidden History. Clark Peters focuses this week on 1910-20, when African-American banjo bands entertained London high society. At 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4, the second of Jonathan Smith's plays celebrating the life of John Betjeman. Mr. Betjeman Regrets is set in 1984 in Cornwall. The poet is now a national treasure, but worries about his career and complex personal life. At 3:30 p.m. on Radio 4 is a new series of Making History. This first episode looks at St. Stephen, the first Christian martyr. Still with Boxing Day, at 8 p.m. on Radio 2 is Sir Roger Moore, Nobody Did It Better, in which Ollie Smith pays tribute to Roger Moore, who died in May of this year. Contributors include his daughter Deborah Moore, actor Michael Caine, and James Bond producer Barbara Broccoli.
Now for a look at Wednesday the 27th of December. On Radio 4 at 11 a.m. in A Place Called Home, Mary Porters takes us on a tour of her hometown of Watford. At 2:15 p.m. is the drama Game Over. A young girl wants her new video game to change the world. And this is followed by at 3 p.m. by a new series of ramblings. Claire Balding takes us walking in Cornwall, from Constantine Bay to Harlin, with two women who've known each other since university. Over on Radio 2 at 5 p.m. comes Paint It Black with Ronnie Wood and Annika Rice. Rolling Stones guitarist Ronnie Wood invites Annika Rice into his home for an insight into his domestic life and his love of art. On Radio 3 at 6:15 p.m, New Generation Artists has recordings by Vaughan Williams, Caroline Shaw and Haydn. Finally, for Wednesday the 27th of December at 11 p.m. on Radio 4, a new comedy series called Life on Egg, with Harry Hill starring as the prison governor of Britain's most remote prison.
Moving on to Thursday 28th of December, and at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Crossing Continents meets the communities struggling to tame the Pilcomayo River, which separates Argentina from Paraguay. A story of human resourcefulness in the face of a massive challenge from Mother Nature. Followed by, at 11:30 a.m, Thinking Outside the Box Set, How Technology Changed the Story, The rise of social media and smartphones looks at how they have changed the way stories are told. The drama at 2:15pm on Radio 4 is Long Time Coming. Rachel is in the supermarket when she is ambushed by a woman who claims to be an old school friend. Mariella Frostrop's guest on Open Book at 3:30pm is comedian and best-selling children's author David Walliams. Finally, for Thursday the 28th of December at 6:30pm on Radio 4, comedian Susan Kalman presents the last in her very funny series of Keep Calm and Carry On. This week, what does she make of bird watching?
Now for Friday the 29th of December. Starting with Radio 4 at 11:30am, funny man David Sedaris reads from his Santaland diaries, which he kept while spending two Christmases in the 1990s as a Christmas elf at Macy's in New York. Over to Radio 2 for Words and Music at 5pm. Enjoy readings featuring fiction's great detectives interdispersed with music. Then at 7:30pm, also on Radio 2, BBC Proms 2017 features a tribute to Ella Fitzgerald and Dizzy Gillespie in their centenary year from the Royal Albert Hall. Finally, at 8pm on Radio 4 is Correspondence Look Ahead. Owen Bennett-Jones is joined by four of the BBC's top foreign and economic correspondents who predict some of the major trends, ideas and people likely to shape our lives over the next 12 months.
And just a few suggestions for listening during the week after Christmas and over the new year. On Saturday the 30th of December, there's the final show of the year from Graham Norton on Radio 2 at 10am, with highlights from the previous shows in 2017, including Mel Brooks, Kelsey Grammer, Ed Sheeran and many more. At 11:15 on Radio 4 Extra, there's a personal and revealing portrait of the singer, songwriter and actress Petula Clark, Downturn Girl. In the afternoon on Classic FM at 5pm, Andrew Collins showcases composers who made their mark this year with some of the best film scores in Saturday Night at the Movies, with everything from Goodbye Christopher Robin to Dunkirk. Then at 7:15pm on Radio 4, Tom Sutcliffe picks out some cultural highlights on 2017 in Saturday Review. Still looking back, but this time right back to 1992, Archive on 4 with Martha Carney reminds us about the year of Black Wednesday, the Maastricht ratification, and the shock general election result when John Major saw off the challenge of Neil Kinnock. That's on Radio 4 at 8pm. Sunday the 31st of December is, of course, New Year's Eve, so there's plenty more looking back to be done.
At 11:15am on Radio 4, Kirsty Young offers an edited version of the programme earlier this year that marked the 75th anniversary of Desert Island Discs, including memorable moments and rediscovered recordings. Drama at 3pm on Radio 4 is the first of a two-part adaptation of John Wyndham's Midwich Cuckoos, performed by a theatre group with a difficult-to-pronounce name, Graeae, where all the performers are disabled. In Greek mythology, apparently, the Graeae, English translation Old Women, Grey Ones or Grey Witches, are called the Grey Sisters. These were three sisters who shared one eye and one tooth among them. In Open Book at 4pm on Radio 4, Mariella Frostrop discusses what makes a good dystopian novel with some of the writers who work in this genre. Apparently, 2017 has seen a lot of these being published, which suggests that utopia is still a long way off. Perhaps by contrast, Sunday Feature on Radio 3 at 6:45pm looks at some of the old stories by Greeks, Vikings and others, which aspire to life extension, survival and immortality. It's called The Immortal North. And finally, for New Year's Eve, there's the traditional news review of the year at 10 p.m. on Radio 4. And let's face it, 2017 has been a pretty eventful year.
Looking now at some of the programmes that run through the week from Monday. At 9 a.m. on Radio 4 each day, Her Story Made History sees Lise Doucet marking the moment 100 years ago that women first won the right to vote, with a series of guests including women's rights activists and politicians. The preview says this is a stirring and inspiring listen, and so it should be. That's on Radio 4 each day at 9 a.m. At 9:45 a.m. each day, still on Radio 4, Book of the Week, The Vital Spark, is Alan Taylor's memoir of his friendship with the writer Muriel Spark, which began in 1990 when he went to the Italian town of Arezzo to interview her. Book of the Week is repeated for Night Owls at 12:30 a.m. each night. At 10:45 a.m. on Radio 4, in the final part of Woman's Hour, there's a 15-minute drama episode each day for the next 2 weeks. It's a mystery based in Tudor times and featuring the sinking of the Mary Rose. It's called Shardlake Heartstone. And this is repeated at 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4 each day. Composer of the Week at 12 midday on Radio 3, from Tuesday through to Friday, is the modern-day composer Colin Matthews, described as an explorer of minimalism. There's lots more starting up this week, including at 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4, the first part of a series called Conflict and Cooperation, A History of Trade. This explores our extraordinary trading past, a timely reminder, perhaps, when we struggle to work out how to have a trading future post-Brexit. The afternoon drama at 2:15 p.m. each day, from Monday to Thursday, on Radio 4, is Elsinore, which tells the turbulent tale of the Danish court, as did Shakespeare in Hamlet, this time set in an alternative Europe in the 1930s. Book at Bedtime at 10:45 p.m. on Radio 4 continues last week's tale of the witchfinder, William Manning. It's called How to Stop Time.
Now just a quick flick through the pages of the Radio Times for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday, January the 1st, former Labour MP Ed Balls explores the recent popularity of socially aware musicals, including Hamilton and the Book of Mormon, in Ed Balls on Musical Theatre. That's on Radio 2 at 3 p.m. On Tuesday, January the 2nd, at 8 p.m. on Radio 4, journalist Anne McElvoy explores the future for the German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany Without Merkel. And then at 10 p.m. on Radio 2, there's the welcome return of Barry Humphreys in the first of a new four-part series called Barry's Forgotten Musical Masterpieces, including music from the period of the Depression in 1920s and 1930s. On Wednesday, January the 3rd, the BBC World Service looks at the illustrious career of the wonderful Aretha Franklin. It's at 11:30 a.m. and it's called Aretha at 75. At 11 p.m. on Wednesday, over on Radio 2, the singer Jimmy Osmond looks at the town of Branson in Missouri, USA, visited apparently by millions of music fans each year, because it is described as the live music show capital of the world. On Thursday the 4th of January, Open Country on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. goes in search of fantastic fairy stories and forgotten football legends around the Yorkshire town of Bradford. At 10 p.m. on Radio 3, Free Thinking studies the ocean, which, like the sky, is too vast and complex for us to understand. Participants include a conversation biologist, a novelist and a historian who has studied the Black Tudor salvage diver who was hired to rescue guns from the wreck of Mary Rose in 1546. And finally, on Friday the 5th of January at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, there's a repeat of My Father's Israel, looking through the eyes of Rami Zabar, whose father was there in 1967 and held strong views about the future of his country. The afternoon play on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. is called The Vital Spark Intelligence and is all about novelist Muriel Spark's time when she was working for M16. And if you remember, the book of the week from Monday to Friday at 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 has been all about Muriel Spark as seen through the eyes of her friend Alan Taylor. So in a way, we end where we began.
And now the second in our series of Community Matters interviews. Our own Rob Pearman talks to Roger Barnes of the Evening Rehearsal Orchestra.
Now, before we begin, I should say that my guest in the studio today, Roger Barnes, has got as bad a cold as I have, so we're liable to cough our way through this one. We'll do our best not to. Roger is the recently retired secretary of something called the Evening Rehearsal Orchestra. Now, when I saw that name first, Roger, I had no idea what it meant. Then I worked it out, because there's three fairly obvious words in there.
Yeah.
First of all, give us a clue as to what it means.
It's an orchestra, the standard classical orchestra, with wind and horns and strings. It's a rehearsal orchestra in that its main principle is that we would never ask anybody to pay to listen to us. So we play for essentially for fun. And it's an evening one because it meets in the evening.
And that will be partly because many of the people in your orchestra are working for a living. So
yes,
they can come in the evening.
And it was designed... I'm also a member of a similar orchestra. It's called the St. Albans Rehearsal Orchestra, which meets on a Wednesday morning. And that was founded in 2000. And it was so successful that I came to feel that there ought to be a market for the same sort of thing for people who can't get around on a morning and who are working. So in 2007, I set about founding an equivalent orchestra to meet on a Monday evening. And we've now been going 10 years.
Let's talk about the sort of people who are members of that orchestra. They've got to be reasonably good, otherwise they wouldn't be able to work together. They're not necessarily at professional standard.
They're certainly not professional standard. Basically, we don't have auditions, so we do not have any minimum standards. I would say that for string players, I don't like talking grades, etc., but grade 4-5 would be a sensible entry level, and people could certainly cope with that and grow with it. Possibly for the woodwind and brass, grade 6. We find, actually, that the people in the orchestra, it finds its own level. Anybody can come. People who find it too easy migrate to a more challenging environment. People who find it too difficult cease to come.
Are there many opportunities I'm thinking of somebody who really enjoys the musical talent that they have and they've played it through their youth and then they get to a point where they've got a choice. They can either pursue it into a professional environment or they have a different career which leaves them only sort of amateur time, if I can put it that way.
We're very fortunate that in St. Albans we have a large number of amateur orchestras with players who are very good indeed. Give regular concerts, and for a lot of good players, there are a number of places they can go to. If you are a woodwind player, you play the flute or the oboe or the clarinet, even though you're very good, you may actually find it difficult to get into an existing orchestra because they all already have the statutory two flutes, two oboes, two clarinets. We can therefore provide a home for people who are temporarily not able to get into the standard they want but want to carry on playing. We could also provide a home for the people who want to get going and haven't played in an orchestra before but can sight read. I think sight read is probably an important qualification. And for string players, people can come at almost any level and work into the level that they're comfortable at.
Does that mean that some people come to you and in due course they will move on to another orchestra?
Yes, that does happen. And the other people that it suits, regardless almost of how good they are the people who can't commit the time every week to one of the good amateur orchestras. Because often, if you miss two or three rehearsals, you won't be allowed to play in the next concert. If I've got a job and I'm a very good clarinetist, but I never know whether I'm going to be sent to Abu Dhabi next week or not, I find it very difficult to fit into the concert-giving amateur scene. And we can offer a home for those sort of people.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm just trying to think of that sort of cultural thing that you have there, because you've got a community of people who've got varying aspirations, but presumably have similar sorts of approaches, which is that they love music. They're not that interested in performing to paying audiences. Is it a community that shares something together? Is that what you've got?
Yes, I think there are some people who actually like the idea of not having to perform, because performing would be stressful. I think there are other people who actually would, in their heart of hearts, prefer to perform, but recognise that actually it's not something that they can currently achieve. It doesn't really matter. Everybody there gets pleasure from the actual coming together and making a coherent sound, which they've contributed to and enjoy.
And the way you do it is you break the year up into three terms, yeah. And each term you set an agenda. I guess it's the conductor that sets the agenda or selects the pieces that you're going to play. How do you do that? You have three or four pieces in each term?
The way it happens is that it's the conductor that makes the choice, but our conductor is extremely good at listening to the voices and actually encourages members to suggest works that they'd like to play. And so each term he will choose three or four pieces for us to work at. This term we're doing Haydn's Drum Roll, 102 Symphony. We're doing the first movement of a Mozart violin concerto, where one of our members is playing the violin solo part. And we're doing a piece by Hamish McCann.
Apart from obviously being Scottish, yeah. Is he famous or anything? I mean,
I think this is his big deal.
Okay.
But I'm told that he appears on Classic FM quite often, right. So he's clearly a good guy.
Okay. Presumably your conductor, he will be choosing things that matches the abilities or the variety?
He'll go for a variety. Secondly, the instruments we've got. Our sort of setup tends not to attract brass players, because you're a trombonist and you come along, you go burp, burp twice. You're not very thrilled. So he has to cope with the fact that there are some bits of the orchestra, particularly the brass, that he doesn't have access to. He goes for variety. I think he probably always tries to pick one piece that he thinks will stretch us a bit.
Because that's another angle, isn't it? Here are people who've got some good skills. You've identified levels of ability. That's not your sole criteria, because you say you don't do auditions, but sight reading is critical. But then is being stretched part of the game?
Being stretched is definitely part of the thing. And from time to time, I think it is good for us to have a piece which we all recognise really stretches us. There's no point in being in your comfort zone all the time.
So people who come to join your orchestra can be assured that they're actually going to learn. They're going to go forward.
Oh, yes. Everybody will go forward.
And over the 10-year period, have a lot of people stayed with you through that time? Or, I mean, you must have natural wastage if people move, as you say.
In the last 10 years, just over 100 people have played with us, some for relatively short periods and have moved on. There would be a core, probably 7 or 8 people that were there on day one and are still with us. Our churn is not that great.
And you've got about how many at the moment?
At the moment, we're about 35 to 40. Strings, woodwind.
If you have a piece that involves something like a piano, which you don't have a pianist there regularly, how do you cope with that?
We're fortunate in the hall we practice in has got a piano. We have done piano concertos or movements from piano concertos, and there the pianist has been one of our violinists or another player who, you know, adds the piano to their other skills.
We've mentioned the conductor a few times. He's not an amateur, he's a professional conductor.
He's a professional conductor. His name is Martin Georgiev. He comes from Varna in Bulgaria. When we were introduced to him, he was on a conducting course at the Royal Academy. He subsequently got a PhD in composition at the Royal Academy. He originally was a percussionist, but decided he wanted to widen his experience and really concentrates on his composition. He's got a website. His music can be heard on that website. He currently has a role as an assistant conductor at the Royal Ballet at Covent Garden, where his responsibility is to do all the major rehearsing with the orchestra and the dancers as they're getting up to bring it up. I think it could be quite interesting when he's doing a new ballet where the music is developing as he's conducting.
So that gives him lots of experience, which he's then able to use in different ways, including working with your evening rehearsal orchestra.
Yes. His musical knowledge and his musicality is immense. We're very, very lucky to have a man of his depth of musicality to take us forward.
He's a young man from Bulgaria. Does he do things there? Is he involved?
Yes, he goes back regularly. He does quite a lot of conducting in Bulgaria, often in connection with the Bulgarian radio people.
You rehearse every week?
36 weeks a year, roughly. Yeah. The amount of time that he has been able to give to us has been remarkable. He's had to pull out, really, on remarkably few occasions. The deal is that if he can't come, it's his responsibility to find someone.
But you don't ask that of members of your orchestra. They don't have to find a replacement. They can't come because
if they don't come.
No. Yes, you hope that you don't lose all the strings on one evening.
That's right. I mean, what I can say is that I don't think there's ever a rehearsal where everybody comes. I don't think we've ever had, at a rehearsal, 100% attendance by those on the list.
Sounds like your fixed costs are going to be paid for a professional conductor and a venue in which to do the rehearsal. You've got to pay for
the
room.
You've got three fixed costs: the venue, your conductor, and hiring the music. As a sort of financial model, it's very easy because, of course, you've only got the fixed costs. All you've got to do is really divide that by the number of people attending.
Yes, so your income is from yourselves.
Entirely, that's right. So if you're spending £200 on an evening and you've got 40 people there...
But if somebody came up to you and said, look, here's a cheque for £500, you wouldn't turn it down.
I don't see there's much point in us, as it were, raising money. We've certainly decided that we would not want to become a charity, even if we qualified. I think it's much easier to see yourself as something which is entirely self-financing, needs no public money or no charitable money, and that you've got members who are enjoying themselves, and they're paying, I mean, at the moment we're paying £6 a session, which is, what, £3 an hour? Which is about a pint of beer.
And so, I mean, you've got a group of people who are doing something. And that's why you use the word community. It's a community of people coming together. Yeah. You are within the community. You're bringing people out of the larger community, but you're not giving anything back to that larger community because you're not performing.
No, but we do try to give back a bit. Of course, we've made a special effort to twin, essentially, with a primary school. We made contact about 5 years ago. And once a year, the orchestra from the Abbey Primary School come along and we have a joint session and we play music that the children have already been practicing at the school. They can then hear it and play it in a much bigger environment. And the conducting is shared by the Marie Price, who's their music teacher and our conductor. And then also, from time to time, one or two of us have actually gone along and sat in and played along with the children at their rehearsals in the school. The idea of that is primarily to make the children understand that this sort of thing is something that adults do. It's not just for children. The other orchestra that I'm in, the St. Albans Rehearsal Orchestra, their outreach is to take the whole orchestra into one or two primary schools a year, not to give a concert, but actually to enable the kids to deconstruct a classical orchestra.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we've got this large body of men and women, etc. Kids are all strung out of lies, etc. So you play a bit so they get an idea of the noise, and then, now where does this noise come from? Oboe makes this sort of, double bass makes this sort of noise, trombone makes this sort of noise. And then you can get them to, if you do pieces which have got strong rhythmic things, you can get them to copy the rhythms. And of course, as a treat, you can get one or two of them up to do some conducting. The idea is not to play at them, although you do obviously do things which are actually a concert piece. But the purpose of doing that is to get them into the orchestra rather than to have them solely as audience. parents on the other side.
But do you think that kids go on from there thinking, I really like that sound that that particular instrument makes? Do you think they helps to choose which one?
I like to think it helps. I think the number of times that you could get a direct causal link pretty would difficult. Be pretty small. Yeah. The important thing, really, is I think, is to get them to recognise that this music playing is not an abnormal thing. It's a perfectly normal thing for people to engage in at all ages.
Now, we've heard some bits of your work while we've been chatting. Does anybody ever hear you when you've got to the end of your term? You've rehearsed all these three pieces or four pieces?
Well, friends and family do. We normally have about 20 sort of friends and family who turn up, and we have a party afterwards, so they get a bit of a reward.
So we can sum it up. You've been going for 10 years. Your evenings only, which means that people who work for a living full-time, part-time, can come to that. You have a variety of mainly strings and woodwind, occasional brass, and it's a community of people that come together to exercise their pleasure in music and in performing for themselves, as it were. And it's a learning experience, and it costs about £5 a time, or £6 from each evening you attend. Are you looking at any time and every time for new members? Do you want to have additions to the 30 or so that you've got currently?
The answer to that is basically yes. We would love to hear from anybody who was interested. We have found that we can't really accommodate more than four of a particular woodwind instrument, so no more than four flutes. But for strings, we've got almost limitless capacity. And if you were a horn player or a trumpet player, I'd bite your hand off.
Yes. What is your instrument that you play? What do you play?
I take the cello with me.
Whether you play it or not is other people's opinion. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in, Roger. It's been great fun to listen to.
Thank you very much for having me.
The final part of the programme is our piece of music, Hello Dawn by Gofby, in its entirety. Many thanks to all our readers today, to Alex for his editorial assistance, to John who makes all the copies of the recording, and to Monty who arranges to get your copy to you. As I mentioned earlier, there will be no programme for the week between Christmas and New Year. This News Extra is therefore the last weekly programme of 2017. However, you will receive, or may indeed already have received, our special Winter Quarterly Magazine programme put together by Mark with the help of Jill and others. The next regular weekly programme will be the primary edition, produced by Robin, and it will reach you at the end of the first week in January. So, if you have time to listen to everything over the holiday period, you'll have last week's especially long Red Saturn, this News Extra, and the Quarterly Magazine. A veritable Christmas feast for the ears. So that's all from me, Steve. I'll be back again with News Extra next month. But before I go, may I, on behalf of all of us at the Talking Newspaper, wish you a very Merry Christmas and a happy and prosperous New Year. Goodbye.